Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 26, 2015, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, where today we'll be discussing the book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome today two experts, including our author. We're going to proceed today, as we sometimes do, in a sort of interview or conversation format between Stephen Klein, our interviewer or moderator. He's an attorney with the Pillar of Law Institute. And our author, Charles Slack, they're going to talk with each other for about 25 or 30 minutes. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So please be thinking of your questions in advance. And now here they are. Gentlemen, Steve Klein, I turn the floor over to you.
Thanks a lot, Dean. Well, I have to open this call today with a bit of a confession, but there's good news at the end of it. Like so many, I'm sure, on this call, I studied American advanced placement history while going through a public high school here in the United States, and then studied American history in college. And perhaps most offensively, found myself practicing First Amendment law for many years, and all this time was under the illusion that I understood what the Sedition Act of 1798 was all about, or at least had a pretty good idea. But that was certainly not the case. The good news is that now a comprehensive history is available, compellingly told, and just a fantastic, wonderful book, and we're here to discuss it today. Charlie Slack, who is a author of three previous nonfiction books, including Hetty, The Genius and Madness of America's First Female Tycoon, and Noble Obsession, Charles Goodyear, Thomas Hancock, and the Race to Unlock the Greatest Industrial Secret of the 19th Century. He works as a freelance writer and lives in Connecticut with his wife and their daughters. And his latest book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Thanks for that great introduction, and it's a real honor to be here with the Federalist Society, a wonderful organization, and I'm sure I would have a lot to learn from the people on the phone today.
Well, you've heard my the broad recommendation for the book at the outset. What inspired you to write it?
Well, I think as a writer, I've always been deeply interested in the First Amendment. I speak to school groups sometimes about being a writer, and I like to tell them that one of the things I really love about my profession is there's only one license you'll ever need, and that's the First Amendment. And I think, like you, I think I was sort of vaguely aware of this thing called the Sedition Act of 1798. Didn't know a whole lot about it other than the fact that shortly after passing this marvelous Bill of Rights, the government turned around and declared it illegal to criticize the government, and that direct contradiction always fascinated me, and it just sort of stayed in the back of my mind, and then it sort of came to the front of my mind, and I started investigating it as a possible book idea.
So as you were researching it, you tell a great there's many narratives going on. After, you know, you tell the story leading up to the passage of the Sedition Act, and you then discuss many of the characters, both behind its passage, its enforcement, and of course the victims. Well, I guess broadly speaking, for those who might not be familiar, what was the Sedition Act, and what were probably the greatest prompts, do you think, to its passage?
Well, the Sedition Act of 1798 was a law enacted by Congress and signed by John Adams, the second president, that essentially made it illegal to call into question the actions to bring into disrepute members of the United States government, members of Congress and the president. And the catalyst for it was both sort of international and domestic. The United States had sort of fallen from the Garden of Eden, this idea that we were going to have this utopia on American shores where we would elect our leaders and they would guide all the people as one, into an increasingly sort of fractious array of different interests and parties. And the looming threat from overseas was the constantly warring England and France. And as Americans sort of drew their different alliances, some favored the English, some favored the French, and there was this sort of direct clash where both sides viewed the other as a direct threat to the future of the country. And the Federalist Party, which controlled the presidency, the Supreme Court, and Congress at the time, felt that the critics were endangering the country with their contrary opinions, and they felt that they had to pass this law stifling criticism.
And of course, there were certainly no shortage of critics, and I think that's probably my favorite part, among my favorite parts of the book, is the number of these characters. And unfortunately, like the Sedition Act itself, it seems some of them are really lost in history. And you describe, and I think it also illustrates the broad impact that the Sedition Act had. It seemed you had Benjamin Franklin Bache, who was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, who was a printer in Philadelphia, who we were discussing shortly before the call, said some things that would even make Donald Trump think twice in today's political climate, or at least printed some things. Matthew Lyon, a legislator himself, being brought under the very law itself and imprisoned back in up north. And even his name escapes me now, this is how bad I am, but even a man uttering something offensive about John Adams on the street, probably after a few beers, found himself on the wrong end. Of all these characters, who did you perhaps enjoy researching the most? Who did you find the most admirable?
Well, the fellow you're speaking of in Newark, New Jersey, his name was Luther Baldwin. And in some ways, I sort of got the most enjoyment out of researching him. My daughter was in college at the time and worked as my researcher over two summers and helped me sort of look in through databases about this guy who really hadn't been investigated terribly thoroughly before. Luther was sort of an outlier. Most of the people who were victimized by the Sedition Act were writers, editors, politicians, people sort of out there with their opinions back in that sort of give and take of politics. And Luther was just a guy, as you say, who got a little drunk one morning with a couple of his buddies, and John Adams and Abigail Adams were rolling through Newark in their carriage on their way back up to Massachusetts in 1798, and some supporters let off a cannon salute. And Luther made the comment that he didn't care if it hit John Adams in the rear end. And for that sort of silly, drunken comment, he was overheard by the owner of the bar, who said that's sedition. And it wound up being a sort of a two-year ordeal for Luther Baldwin. And it's a humorous story. It's always been treated as kind of a comic footnote by historians because he wasn't a thinker. He wasn't a statesman. But to me, in addition to being an entertaining story, it's also one of the most important because it really shows how these laws intended for one purpose can start reaching their icy fingers down into the population and clamping down on liberty. And I don't mean this flippantly, but if you're not free to make a drunken offhand joke on the street corner about a politician, then freedom is really in trouble.
And so we have not only a wide variety of victims, but you also do an excellent job describing not only was this law passed, perhaps some more reluctant than others to do so, but there were certainly a number of not just legislators who voted in favor of it, President John Adams, shockingly, who signed it, and then courts that, and this is, I should remind the audience, this is the years before Justice Marshall established judicial review. This was the courts even certainly allowed this to go on, including Samuel Chase, a judge who would certainly have plenty more drama in his life after the Sedition Act expired. Do you believe there's maybe one or a few central characters who may bear the most blame for the impact of the Sedition Act or enforcing it?
Well, I think that it's at some level John Adams. It comes back to him, and it doesn't mean he wasn't a great man. But I think in his case, putting his name on the Sedition Act, it was something that in his later years he tried to distance himself from and say that he didn't have really that much to do with it. And his chroniclers over the decades and centuries since his presidency have sort of done the same, tried to minimize his role. To me, his putting his name on the Sedition Act was the great tragedy, a personal tragedy, because of all of the founders. He had been one of the most forceful, probably the most forceful and eloquent in his earlier years in supporting free speech. And in fact, there was one writing from his 30s when he actually reached out to printers and said, "Don't let people in authority accuse you of sedition. Be brave and print." I'm paraphrasing, of course, but so when he put his name on that, it really was a personal tragedy. And also, as I lay out in my book, he wasn't a sort of distant participant. He actually participated in at least one of the prosecutions. He refused to pardon this poor fellow, David Brown, up in Massachusetts, who had been really railroaded and spent months and months and months in prison. And he attempted to reward the prosecutor who went after Luther Baldwin, the drunken guy I described earlier, with high public office towards the end of his presidency. And many people saw that as payback for going after Luther Baldwin. So John Adams was really involved. And I think beyond him, Timothy Pickering, who was the Secretary of State under Adams, is probably the most dastardly character, sort of the Snidely Whiplash of the story. He was one of these guys who, I think whenever you pass a law that clamps down on freedom, there's always somebody there to take advantage and scheme and get really nasty. And Timothy Pickering had sort of legions of informers around the country who would send him snippets of newspapers or articles from newspapers that were critical of the government. And Pickering would then turn around and instruct the prosecutors in that area to launch sedition trials. He was quite a character, and I would put a lot of the blame for the actions of the Sedition Act on him.
I believe you mentioned in the book that another biographer attempted to set out years back to try and redeem Pickering's reputation and maybe establish that he wasn't all that bad of a guy. But after much research, he came up with the conclusion that he really was that bad of a guy.
That's right. That's right. There's a guy, Gerald Clarfield, a biographer who set out to rescue and then set up. I guess the stories are true.
So, and you mentioned earlier Adams, his later writings, and I certainly commend your work in the book with not just reference, but even quotations from writings that were going on at the time. Some of them, because the Sedition Act had gone into effect and because particularly Republicans of the day were the ones under the threat of being prosecuted under it, were again writing defenses similar to free speech, similar to what Adams had written around the time of the Revolution. Of all those primary sources, what do you think, if someone wanted to, in addition to reading your book, if people were to read those primary sources, what do you think the most important are to look up on Google Books or elsewhere?
Well, that's a great question, and I think this is where the internet is this marvelous tool that of course has never existed for previous investigators or readers. And there's so much primary information that you can have very quickly. And I think that one thing I would recommend, one resource, would be the Annals of Congress, which are the sort of daily back and forth of the House of Representatives through that period. And you can easily find them at the Library of Congress website. And it's fascinating to see how these guys turned over in their minds and examined the basic issues of freedom and what it meant and what were the limits of free speech and did this or that constitute a violation that we can't accept. And you find that they were arguing and mulling over the very same conflicts and ideas that we do today. The subjects were just a little bit different. And so, and also the very existence of the Annals of Congress is a testament to free speech, because it's based on the newspaper reporting that all of the reporters did as they were watching the goings on. That's a vital resource. Also, the papers of the various founders are readily available online, of Adams and Jefferson and Madison and others, and you can read the letters back and forth and catch them in unguarded moments and see sort of what they really thought about certain issues. So there are a lot of great primary resources out there. And then for other reading, much more modern, I think we really benefit from the new round of wonderful biographies of the individual founders that have been done. It sort of started with David McCullough's John Adams, you know, Ron Chernow's Washington and Hamilton, John Meacham's Jefferson. And we can't ever know these people, of course. They've been dead for a couple of centuries. But these writers each sort of inevitably become advocates in a way for their characters. And so when you read these different biographies and you bring them together and you see how the different takes on the crucial events, it's sort of the closest that we can come to actually knowing these leaders.
So now turning, and I think there's much to be read in the book, a very rich history, but you close with a very eloquent lesson, I would say, an essay kind of discussing what we should really be taking away from Liberty's first crisis. And first of all, I certainly commend you. It's not something you typically see in a history book, so I was really pretty impressed with that. And what do you think, just the broadly opening, what do you think is the greatest threat to free speech that we face in America today?
Well, thank you very much. It was important to me that this not just be a history story. I mean, I loved the historical aspects of it, but what I really love most about this is that the issue is still very much alive, and it's something that we've got to continue to protect. It's very easy to lose these freedoms. And I think the greatest threat, the greatest ongoing threat to free speech is the idea, it's human nature for anybody who gets in power. It's very easy for us to see when somebody is threatening our rights to free speech. But it's when it's somebody that we hate, somebody we disapprove of, somebody we think is totally wrong and hurting the country, when we talk about limiting that person's rights, that's the danger to me, because it's very easy to say, well, that's, if anything, will improve freedom by shutting that guy up because he's a lunatic. And so I think when it comes to things like hate speech laws and political speech laws and that kind of thing, or some of this idea that the First Amendment is really about public freedom, which is this idea that's sort of been floated in the last couple of decades, that really the First Amendment exists as a political tool to create a better government, and therefore we should somehow, you know, sort of elevate some voices and lower other voices in order to have a more balanced and democratic speech. I think all of these things are very direct threats to freedom of speech and things that we need to be careful about.
And we see also, and I think it's funny that today, even today, we get serious, but also a bit of levity. I guess I should switch those. They may be funny at first glance, but they are very serious to the people under those threats. You discussed earlier the Luther Baldwin and his perhaps intoxicated utterance about President Adams. And just last week, the New Hampshire Supreme Court overturned a law that prohibited photographing one's ballot. Now, this is allegedly, ostensibly a law that was enacted to prevent voter fraud or people from taking pictures of their ballot, marked ballots, so that they would show it and get paid off. But the people actually brought into court who actually had to sue because they were being threatened with a $1,000 penalty included a man who took a picture of a ballot after writing in Akira, which was the name of his recently deceased dog, and posting it on Facebook with the line that none of the candidates on the ballot were qualified. So that's certainly an example of direct censorship, and unfortunately we'll continue to see that. But you also, and that's of course brought under an actual law that now in the post-Justice Marshall era, we can challenge and have judges say, no, that is an unconstitutional law and prevent prosecution under it. Do you worry as much about cultural censorship as legal censorship?
I don't think I do, because I think if for example, a good example, I guess, of cultural censorship might be much what's going on college campuses and the political correctness, and I think that's deeply unfortunate, and I think that people should go to college to be exposed to all different kinds of ideas, and the idea that we should be nurturing a generation that's afraid of ideas or needs safety from ideas is ludicrous and deeply unfortunate. To me, though, the real issue in preserving freedom is the matter of when the government steps in, because the government is the one entity that we entrust with the guns and the ability to lock us up, and so everybody else at some level has to rely on persuasion to get us to change our minds. The government is the one entity that has the power to lock us up and fine us. So to me, that's where the greatest threat lies.
Last week, you had a letter to the editor. I believe it was in the Denver Post, relating to some certain happenings in Denver, where some individuals were gathered outside of a courthouse, handing out literature relating to jury nullification. They were then faced some punishment, or at least censorship, from handing out those that literature. If you could tell us more about that, and I'm curious, do you see yourself writing more about this topic as these kind of issues come up in the future?
Yeah, I do. I really love to, as you graciously pointed out about sort of my book bringing it up to modern times. I think that these are vital conversations to keep having, and I'd love to be a part of it. The case in Denver, and I only know it from what I read in the editorial that I responded to in the Denver newspaper, but it was about some people arrested for handing out pamphlets outside the courthouse encouraging jury nullification. And I think, of course, there are sort of real dangers about nullification, and there are positives and negatives, and it's a debate. It's an important debate that we need to have. I think the disturbing thing is the idea of arresting people for handing out literature, and that's what I was speaking to. And in my letter, I did note that during the Sedition Act, the jurors were specifically instructed by the judges, who in many cases, as you noted at the outset, were Supreme Court justices, Samuel Chase and others, would directly instruct the jurors not to take into account their own perspective on the law, whether the law was just or not, the moral issues, but only to determine whether the person on trial had or had not written the allegedly offensive article. So essentially, since everybody knew that they had written the article, you had open and shut cases. There really was no point to have the trial other than as a show. And I think that sort of really speaks to the dangers on the other side, when people aren't allowed to sort of bring a sense of right and wrong into the jury room with them.
Yeah, well, with that, Dean, I think we're ready to turn it over to the audience.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We look forward to taking as many of your calls as possible here today. Before we do that, let me make an announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Our next scheduled call is this Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about one of the pending Dodd-Frank lawsuits. This is a suit where the D.C. Circuit Court very recently ruled that the plaintiffs have standing, at least with regard to very important parts of the suit, so that lawsuit will continue. Today, though, we're talking with the author of Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech, and we're taking questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have just one question, then our lines are wide open. So let's take our first call.
Hi. Yeah, a few years ago, the Bar Associations had as the theme for their Law Day celebration, Adams, from the Boston Massacre to the Alien and Sedition Acts to the Patriot Act. And so they were looking for something that go along with that theme, and I had a Revolutionary War outfit for my historical reenactments. And so I looked for something that Adams had said about the Alien and Sedition Acts, and I couldn't find a real quote. Somebody said that he regarded it as his greatest mistake. But I found a journalist, James T. Callender, who said a tremendous amount about Adams. And so I took a bunch of quotes of his, and we staged an imaginary debate with Abigail Adams, where she was defending the Alien and Sedition Acts, and he was attacking the Federalists and Adams and everybody else associated with that. At the end of that, the comment that I got from a lot of people was, nothing has changed. I put it on video, not the one at the Bar Association, their camera failed. And it's on YouTube now under Chris Garvey and James T. Callender. You could look it up, or you Google it, or you could I could give you the site. But did you come across Callender in your studies?
I think that's a great story. I just wrote down your name, and I'm going to look it up as soon as we get off. I can't wait to see it. Yes, Callender is a major part of my book, and he's really one of the most fascinating characters. He was a journalist. He had from Scotland. He spent his whole life sort of being offended by anybody who was in power, and he was so your classic sort of misanthrope. And he was an alcoholic, but he was a brilliant journalist, and he just spent his entire career ticking off anybody who was in power on both sides of the Atlantic. And he wrote sort of courageously, fearlessly. He was the journalist who as an opposition to the Federalists, he wrote about Alexander Hamilton, whom he despised, and exposed Hamilton's extramarital affair with Mariah Reynolds. And he fearlessly criticized John Adams. And as you suggest, Abigail came to his to Adams's defense. She was a loyal spouse, and she believed that the Sedition Act was needed to cut off the heads of the vipers, as she put it. And Callender was certainly
and
one
French.
Of the.
And the French.
What's that?
And the French,
I'm
who
sorry?
Were invading our country as immigrants from the French Revolution.
That's right. The French, the Irish. I'd love to remind you of that. I could talk about the immigrant situation, which is pretty funny. But so Callender then Thomas Jefferson, who was sort of a consummate politician, he was the vice president to Adams, but in opposition, and didn't make waves publicly, but quietly he funded journalists. He would give them $50 here and there to Benjamin Franklin Bache and to James Callender to keep them going. Callender wound up getting charged with sedition in Richmond, Virginia, put on trial. And his case, Adams helped arrange the defense, and it was sort of a turning point because even though he was convicted, the defense was brilliant because they arranged Jefferson and Monroe sort of arranged this dream team of defendants to defend Callender and really showed up a lot of the hypocrisy behind the Sedition Act. Callender went to jail. Jefferson was elected president, defeated Adams. And Callender figured that he was now due for some kind of a presidential appointment for being such a loyal supporter. Well, Jefferson, the consummate politician, knew that Callender had been very valuable sort of as this rogue, unhinged critic of Adams, but he knew he didn't need him in his administration, and informed Callender that there would be no appointment, and tried to buy him off with $50 and hoped he would go away. And Callender was incensed and promptly switched his allegiance from the Republican Party to the Federalists and began attacking Jefferson. And he was actually the journalist who first exposed the affair with Sally Hemings, Jefferson's slave. So he was behind a lot of the big stories of the day. A really, really fascinating character.
He was found drowned in a few, very few inches of water, allegedly.
Yeah, there were ideas that maybe some there was some foul play, but he was such a self-destructive figure that it's hard to believe that anything besides he was seen wandering around and he drowned in 3 feet of water in the James River, and then they.
I think it was water. Someone had held his face down.
Well, it was in the James River, and they dragged him up onto Church Hill, and he's buried up there, that right next to the church where Patrick Henry gave his "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. Fascinating character.
Yes.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, our lines are wide open at this point. We don't have any callers pending. You need to push the star button and then the pound button to join the conversation. While we're waiting to see who joins, I have just one quick question, Mr. Slack, that you could probably answer pretty quickly. I know authors don't always get to choose the titles of their books, but I was intrigued by the subtitle. It's Liberty's First Crisis, but the subtitle, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. I'm particularly interested in the word misfits. Can you say more about the selection of that word in the title?
Sure, and I appreciate your bringing that up. And misfits was actually part of the title that I was really insistent be in there. I think I had an original title that was actually sort of something different, and I think that Liberty, back and forth with the publisher, and Liberty's First Crisis, I think, was a great title that really sort of framed the issue. And then to get Adams and Jefferson in there to show sort of the magnitude of the issues at stake, but I had always seen this book really as a book about those misfits, because it's always, whether you're talking 1798 or 2015, it's always somebody with an axe to grind. It's always somebody who doesn't quite fit into society, who forces us to test our commitment to free speech. Free speech never revolves around Betty Crocker's new extra fudgy brownie recipe. It's always somebody who is trying to provoke, trying to make people angry, and by definition is sort of a misfit.
We do have two questions pending, so we'll turn to those in a moment. But let me just ask one really quick follow-up question, if I could. And that's, you mentioned the modern-day threats in response to a question by Stephen Klein, the hate crimes, maybe some of the campus speech stuff. I don't know if you talked about the campus speech stuff. How is that? Is that worse in some ways and not quite as threatening in other ways? One distinction I see is that the Sedition Act seemed to be even more self-serving in the sense that the folks who adopted it were trying to preserve their own reputations, you could say, while a lot of the folks that are adopting hate crimes or the campus speech, maybe some of the campus speech stuff is trying to preserve their own academic environment and their own place of work or something like that. But are those in some ways better, in some ways worse, or can you say more about that?
Well, I think you make a fair point about the direct self-interest of a politician making it illegal to criticize politicians. That's a very fair point. But to me, the underlying issue is whether you can preserve freedom while declaring offending someone to be illegal. And I don't think that works. Whether it's a racial matter or criticizing a politician or saying something else offensive, the problem is for freedom to exist, you have to have a thick skin. We have to agree that you're going to be offended sometimes in a free society. Because if you outlaw or if you make it illegal to say offensive things, what you're doing is you transfer the right to speak from the speaker to the listener. And and then it goes from being a right to sort of a political permission. You're always going to say, if you say anything controversial, it's going to be offensive to somebody. And so then it becomes who has political cover and who doesn't. And so if we've decided that certain terminology is offensive today, tomorrow it might be another certain set of terminologies that we find offensive, and it all depends on who's in power. So I think if we want to prevent the erosion of our rights, we have to sort of agree that being offensive is not illegal.
Once again, we're talking with the author of Liberty's First Crisis, Charles Slack. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions pending, so let's take another call.
Even after the lessons of the Alien Sedition Act, the government became involved later in censoring speech under the bad tendency doctrine. So people were censored based upon anticipated behavior. And so as we look at Supreme Court jurisprudence that corrected that, and then later in decades, we had what was called the heckler's veto. And so small groups were claiming that they should have protected status because of offended sensibilities. We are in a position now where, despite a long line of Supreme Court cases that vindicate liberty and speech, local governments, so even beyond campuses, have a tendency, in light of safety considerations, to ban some speech under a heckler's veto in interest of some groups that threaten incendiary action. So what arguments won the day that could be used again, and this might even go back through the years of bad tendency doctrine, that we might apply now back from the alien sedition debates?
That's a wonderful question. And I think what Thurgood Marshall's famous quote about liberty at times of crisis, liberty seemed too extravagant to endure. I'm not quoting precisely, but I think that really sort of says it. It's where when we feel threatened. I think the opening sentence of my book or the opening page talks about this idea: when fear mounts, people's respect for liberty decreases. And I think that I couldn't point to a specific incident in the Sedition Act saga, other than the fact that I think that what the country woke up to was, and it took a while, but was the idea that even under this sort of time of fear, when we were terrified of an invasion from France or all of the different things going on, that the specter of throwing people into jail for using their constitutional rights was unacceptable. And it was something that took months and months and months for people to wake up to. But then they said, wow, this guy Matthew Lyon, this congressman from Vermont, he's out campaigning, criticizing John Adams, and he's thrown in jail, and he gets reelected from his jail cell in Vergennes, Vermont. I mean, this is the way people sort of began to vocalize their sense that an injustice had occurred. I think that the Americans are sort of slow sometimes to wake up to these threats, but ultimately they do. And I think you're making a great point that it's not just sort of Congress, and it happens all the time. People pass these little laws and these measures that seem reasonable in the context of our fear, or they seem, well, we're just going to shut that total lunatic up. But ultimately what we come around to realize is that it's the measure itself, not the lunatic, that represents the most substantial threat.
And this is Steve Klein, and I would only interject, because I certainly thought about this topic a lot as reading Charlie's book. And I think especially looking at the 20th century and looking at history, we can go abroad, and the beauty of free speech is, while we, you know, especially here in the Federalist Society, we think legally, we think constitutionally, and that's very important. It is indeed the way to secure freedom is with law and well-written law. But ultimately, you know, freedoms, they are unalienable. They are given by a creator, or they're natural to man. And that can't be taken away. And I think I think of the 20th century. I think of Vaclav Havel. I think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who under regimes far more oppressive than anything America has ever witnessed, just wouldn't shut up. And I think ultimately there is something to be said about freedom, even aside from the law is only given up when we actually give it up as individuals.
I think that's really, really well said.
We've got just one question pending, and then our lines are open. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question now.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS, and I'm impressed with your depth of knowledge on this and the details. And I would like to look at liberty not just in terms of speech, but in doing things. And in inventing a sustainable transportation system, I've come to learn that liberty is society's tolerance for disruptive minorities, and there is no minority as disruptive as inventors. What could you do and what things could you look at relative to the post-Roads restriction in the Constitution and applying it to limit federal involvement in things that they are unconstitutionally limited to?
I think that's a great question, and it does get a little off of the free speech area, but I think these freedoms are connected, and I'm a real believer in capitalism, and I think too many people unfortunately define or think of capitalism as being large corporations in cahoots with government agencies and edging the little guy out. And I think of capitalism as being freedom. It's free speech is the right to conceive your ideas and express them, and capitalism is the freedom to carry those ideas out, whether it's to form a commune or to start a company and to pursue your vision. And I think that to the extent that we can keep government there at the dividing line of when freedoms clash, when my use of my freedom directly infringes some freedom of yours, that's where government needs to make the decision and not to sort of get involved and overregulate and stifle the use of freedom. So I applaud inventors and entrepreneurs, and as a freelance writer myself, I consider myself a capitalist.
This is Dean. Our questions keep trickling in. We've got one more question pending. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're speaking with Mr. Charles Slack, author of Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. Let's take another call now.
Hi, this is Chris Garvey again. One of the things that killed the Alien and Sedition Act was that the Federalists had the good sense to put a term limit on the act so that it expired when their term of office expired, so it couldn't be used against them. And, of course, the other thing that kept it from happening again for a long time was they were soundly defeated in the election. And, of course, the Federalists were crony capitalists in the modern sense of the word, and or mercantilists, as they were called back then. They believed the government should be subsidizing favored businesses. This tradition of restricting things is going on today, where Ruben Diaz in New York City wants to ban anybody from wearing a shirt so that he can ban women from going topless in Times Square without violating equal protection. And this Puritan streak has been running through this country since the 1600s and has provided an excuse for restricting speech and action and public performance.
Well, that's a great point. You're quite right also about the craftiness of the Federalists when they framed the law to end with the term of John Adams's presidency and with the congressional term. And I think the idea being that if they were reelected, they could resurrect the law, and if not, it would pass out of existence, which it did. And I think there's sort of good and bad in each of the founders, and if you're telling a different story, there are different heroes and villains. But Thomas Jefferson, to my mind, one of his finest moments was his inaugural address when he famously said, "We are all Republicans, we're all Federalists," and he specifically said during his inaugural address that what's the harm? We're strong enough. What's the harm if somebody gets up and says things we don't like? Even if they call for the downfall of our country, aren't we strong enough to withstand that? And that sort of that address, to my mind, put the coda on the Sedition Act, and it was not returned. Resurrected by the Republicans to use against the Federalists. They didn't do that. But of course, we've had sort of no end of threats to free speech over the years. There was a Sedition Act during World War I, and people were rounded up and thrown in jail, and newspapers were tampered with by the government. So these are lessons that we need to continue learning and teaching ourselves over and over again.
Well, Stephen Klein, we don't have any questions pending. And if you have some more questions you want to ask our author, we do have another audience question, so let's check back in with one more caller.
Hi, my name is Ambrose Madison Richardson. My uncle has credit for compiling the Bill of Rights, if not drafting them, so I have a special interest in it. I'm also president of the Sons of the Revolution in the state of New York, and we own and maintain Francis Tavern, where we said liberty began, where the Sons of Liberty met and planned. I don't see Mr. Slack's book on our list of books that we're reviewing in 2015 for our annual award, and I wonder if he would be interested in submitting it for that purpose.
I'd be very interested. Let me know where and how.
Okay, let me, why don't you call in? Our number is 212-425-1776, and leave your contact information, and we'll be in touch.
I will do that. Thank you very much for the suggestion.
Okay, thanks.
Let me make a final call for questions then. We still have a few minutes left. If you have a question or comment, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Seeing none, Stephen Klein, I turn it back over to you.
Well, Dean, in closing, and thanks again for being with us, Charlie, really appreciate the time. And I just have to at least get a quote in from your book. This is from the closing chapter, and I think it's a really apt way to close this. It is up to each person to decide, singly or in voluntary association with others, what the, quote, purpose, unquote, of free speech is, what the First Amendment is, quote, for, unquote. One woman uses her speech rights to advance a political agenda. Another writes haikus. One man angrily blogs that George W. Bush is a fascist or Barack Obama is a communist. Another writes cookbooks. One yearns to leave a mark on the world and will keep shouting until someone listens. Another is content to live in solitude and not be heard at all. The purposes of freedom are as multitudinous as the imaginations of more than 300 million Americans. Yet as far as government is concerned, there can be only one. The purpose of freedom is freedom. Thanks again for being with us, Charlie. It was a really fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor, and I really enjoyed myself.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. Once again, I'll thank you both on behalf of the Federalist Society. It certainly was an interesting conversation. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled telephone conference call Friday at 1 p.m. when we'll be discussing one of the challenges to Dodd-Frank. That's Friday at 1 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.